States v. Castillo. Counsel for the appellant, are you ready to proceed, please?
Yes.
Thank you.
Chief Judge Baker, members of the court, I am Captain Aaron Hinkenbrand, along with my co-counsel, Captain Michael Melios. We represent the appellant in this case, Sergeant Eric Castillo. Implied bias in the liberal grant mandate addressed historic concerns about the real and potential for command influence on member deliberations. Sergeant Castillo's case strikes at the heart of those concerns for two primary reasons. First, the prosecutor served as the primary military justice advisor to the panel present. And second, the perception of bias created by that relationship could not be overcome, where the panel president sat with two of his primary staff members. He himself was the victim of a sexual assault, and the trial counsel had provided military justice assistance to about half the panel. Here, the pre-existing relationship between the Lieutenant Colonel Diaz and the trial counsel is unacceptably similar to their relationship inside the courtroom.
Now, hang on. You're not arguing a per se disqualification, right?
No, Your Honor. What I'm arguing is similar to what this court held in Wiesen. This is a clear application of the facts to the law. And here, where you have a prosecutor giving legal advice to a panel member on a frequent and regular basis, and the subject of that advice is military justice advice on the disposition of specific cases, at that point, you have implied bias. That's because...
Sounds like a per se rule to me.
Your Honor, it's not a per se rule because it could be overcome by other issues such as operational concerns.
Well, what about could it be overcome by the time, the temporal measurement here? Here we're only talking about 3 months, aren't we? We're not talking about a year-long or 18-month-long relationship. This guy had been here for 3 months as the commander. He consulted with the attorney once a week or once every 2 weeks during that time. Is that enough of a period to establish this close bond that we're concerned about?
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, 3 months was significant because in that 3 month period of time, they met 6 to 12 times at least, according to the panel member, and it was on a regular weekly to bi-weekly basis.
Is there a magic number that we look for? Is it a month? Is it 10 meetings? What do we look for? I mean, I understand you're going to argue that this is sufficient, but I mean, for our purposes, what is sufficient?
Your Honor, first I'd point out that this type of relationship, this fixed counselor-counselee type relationship, is highly suspect in and of itself. And I'm not saying that every time a commander in the trial counsel's unit is sitting on the panel, he should be kicked. However, once that member, that commander, has initiated this relationship in a substantive way, or has actually started receiving it.
When you say commander, are you saying every company commander, every brigade commander, every battalion commander, every platoon commander, or are you defining commander in some other way?
Your Honor, every commander that receives substantive legal advice in military justice, a commander can dispose of criminal cases. That's what I'm speaking about. So in the Marine Corps, for example, platoon commander,
so we
should be a commander for
how are you defining it, though? So it sounds like you're defining it at the brigade or battalion level?
I would include...
For your whatever principle of law you wish that we would establish.
Your Honor, I would also include company commanders who receive this advice under the factors that I pointed out. They're receiving the advice on a regular, frequent basis, and that advice is based on the disposition of specific criminal cases, as opposed to giving general advice on how a court martial.
Well, isn't that inherent in the system? Are you saying this is a systemic thing?
It is systemic, at least in the Army system, with respect to brigade judge advocates, because they have a different type of relationship with their units than we see in other places. As we saw, as this court discussed in Richardson, for example, there appears that when a commander needed legal services, he would submit a legal services request through his non-attorney legal officer in the unit. He would then forward it on to Legal Team Echo. Legal Team Echo would then assign an attorney to address that issue. So,
well, it's certainly the way the Air Force handles it.
I'm not aware.
Trial counsel sitting in the base. You got commanders. They're advising them. They work for the staff, Judge Atkins. Same thing. It's inherent in the system.
To some extent, it is.
Yeah, okay. Do we need a per se rule then? Because that's what you seem to be saying.
I don't mean that it's a per se rule, Your Honor, because simply because the trial counsel is assigned to this unit and this person has to be commander of the unit doesn't necessarily mean the trial counsel has given specific military justice advice frequently on a regular basis. It could be that they've never spoken with that commander, or it's only been once or twice, hasn't been substantive, specific to a case.
So only commanders that don't need any legal advice can sit on court martials, it sounds like.
To some extent, Your Honor.
How do we balance that against Article 25's suggestion or command that convening a court-martial, that convening authorities are supposed to pick those people that, in his opinion, are best qualified to duty by reason of age, education, training, experience, like the service and judicial temperament? I mean, aren't those the sorts of people that we would expect to see in command positions?
Yes, of course, Your Honor. And I don't think there's any conflict between what I'm arguing and what the code provides for. That's because once a convening order is created, you have a number of people on there from different units sometimes, and it's not necessarily going to happen if the trial counsel has a commander from the unit on the panel, and it's not necessarily going to be an issue where the trial counsel has actually provided for advice to that commander on a frequent or regular basis. So it's not an issue that's necessarily going to happen all the time, or that can't be handled in the system or would cause any real problem. I mean, the military judge can assess the facts and circumstances at trial to determine if this relationship that goes beyond just knowing each other, and also the military judge can determine if operational necessity comes into play that would somehow justify keeping the member if there is this special relationship.
So this court-martial took place in Korea, did it?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there anything in the record indicating whether there was operational necessity or size of unit issues or anything like that about Camp Humphrey, perhaps, that would indicate the need to pick from a smaller pool of members, that kind of thing?
No, Your Honor. There is no mention of that in the record.
Either way?
Correct, Your Honor. So we don't know why, in this case, the convening authorities decided to choose only members from Sergeant Castillo's.
Counsel, you seem to be articulating a rebuttable presumption rather than a per se rule.
Yes, Your Honor.
Can you point to anything in our prior precedent having to do with imposing a rebuttable presumption in these types of cases?
I don't know of any case where this court has imposed that sort of a rule. However, the Seventh Circuit in U.S. v. Polichemi did discuss at some length the common law understanding of this issue and cited a number of types of relationship the common law has recognized.
But doesn't the code take us out of the common law?
I think it does. It does to some extent, Your Honor, but at the same time, our view of the statutes we work with is informed by how courts for hundreds of years have viewed implied bias in jury cases. And one of those relationships mentioned by the Seventh Circuit and the Third Circuit, subsided in that case, was the counselor relationship. So this is one of those relationships, a counselor-counselor type relationship, has been suspect for many, many years, and could serve as a basis for a rebuttable presumption when certain facts are true. And again, those facts should establish a frequent and regular advisory relationship that's specific to military justice in disposing of certain cases. Because what happens then, once you establish those two factors of that relationship inside and outside the courtroom, looks too simple for any member of the public to think it's okay. It isn't okay. And I think it defies reality to state that you have a trial counsel here who's working with this commander on a regular basis, telling him or at least suggesting to him what he should do with this soldier or that soldier when he or she gets in trouble, that somehow they don't establish a relationship, or somehow that commander isn't going to view his trial counsel's advice more favorably than he would that of a trial counsel.
Would you address the fact that the president was the victim of a child sexual assault?
Yes, Your Honor. That issue highlights or heightens our concern that the member in this case was biased toward the government, or at least was sympathetic.
Actual bias?
No, not actual bias, Your Honor. In this case, the member states specifically that it was a different issue and that it wouldn't affect his decision-making at all. However, under the totality of the circumstances, when we see that he's already got this established relationship with the prosecutor, you add that in, and it certainly looks like you have a member here who's not only highly influential because he rates two of his primary staff members on the panel, but also that he is favorable toward the government for two reasons. He has a relationship with the trial counsel, and he himself can commiserate with the victim in this case, both in the merits and...
Well, it sounds like to you that's the nyop on top of the pre-existing relationship. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I would agree with Captain Zerudian that this issue, a very similar issue was addressed in Rome, where you had a significant, one significant concerns, another more minor concerns, and the court stated that the significant concerns should have been sufficient for implied bias. But even if it wasn't, in light of all the other circumstances presented, it certainly did create implied bias.
Why don't you make sure you tick-tock your cumulative facts? You said all the other circumstances, but the majority of your time at oral argument's been spent on the relationship with the brigade commander. What else is there? There's the prior, and you cited to the sexual assault victim thing. What else?
Yes, Your Honor. Four of the seven members in this case had previous existing relationships with the trial counsel based on his role as the brigade trial counsel. Also, two of those members were on the Lieutenant Colonel Diaz's primary staff as his subordinates.
He was a raider?
Yes, Your Honor. One was his S2 intelligence officer. The other one was his battalion command sergeant major. And I believe these are individuals he would see every day. That, on top of the fact that all the people on the panel came from Sergeant Castillo's brigade, creates an implication for the public that this is a panel that's affected by command influence. It has that appearance, and it certainly has that appearance when you add Colonel Diaz's relationship with the trial counsel.
Counsel, in regard to that, can I explore that a little bit with you? In terms of this hypothetical member of the public who is looking at this and determining whether it seems fundamentally unfair, would that member of the public be considering the responses to the actual bias questions in terms of determining whether there was an implied bias? What I mean by that is, if in the course of asking questions in voir dire, the commander is saying, that sexual assault involving me didn't affect me at all. The members who were raided by the more senior person on the panel were saying, that won't affect my deliberations. Even though those answers were gained through the actual bias construct, would this hypothetical member of the public consider that and determine whether it was an implied bias?
Yes, Your Honor. I think, of course, it would be part of the consideration. But here, when the issue here goes to our historic concerns about how our panels are selected, which is significant, as the convening authority hand selecting the members from the guild, then when that circumstance is highlighted by something that is addressed in voir dire, then the sincerity of the member is less relevant to the issue. And that's And I would compare that to, say, the prior experience as a victim in this case. There, it would be personal to the member, and so he or she's view of how it affects them would be more relevant. However, when what they're saying is, yes, the prosecutor is my legal advisor who I meet with once a week or once every other week to decide how to dispose of criminal cases, then if he says that doesn't affect his view of the case, then that it seems difficult for the public to buy it. Regardless of what he says, it doesn't look appropriate, and it certainly doesn't look appropriate for the convening authority is the one who selected the members from the beginning, and the trial counsel is representing the government in a criminal case. So, barring any further questions.
Thank you very much. You'll have time on rebuttal. Counsel for the government, please.
Chief Judge Baker, members of the court, may it please the court. I, along with Major Daniel Derner, represent the government in this case. A close examination of each of the five areas upon which appellant challenges Lieutenant Colonel Diaz demonstrates that none give rise individually to a claim of implied bias. Moreover, even when considered collectively, there is no risk that the public would perceive that the accused did not receive a fair trial because Lieutenant Colonel Diaz sat on his court-martial. As such, the military judge did not run afoul of the United States v. Bagstad standard. I would ask this court to do two things in considering this case. First, I would ask this court to unpack the three bases that were raised at trial and appellant now relies upon in his brief. That would be Lieutenant Colonel Diaz as a sexual assault victim, the ongoing reliance of Lieutenant Colonel Diaz on the military for military justice advice on the trial counsel, and also the presence of other members who, in appellant's words, relied on the military on the trial counsel for military justice advice. And additionally, I would ask this court to apply the rule of forfeiture to the other two bases that appellant briefs. And that would be first that the panel was selected exclusively from Sergeant Castillo's brigade, and secondly, that all of these things cumulatively would be what give rise to a claim of implied bias.
But aren't we supposed to look at the totality of the circumstances, the totality of the environment, and wouldn't that necessarily include everything?
Yes, Your Honor. This court's case law, I would submit, is a little unclear as to whether or not that challenge has to be made on the record at trial in order to be preserved. In Townsend, this court appeared to consider all of the bases collectively, even though it's not clear from the record that appellant raised that at trial and that it was briefed by appellant at the appellate level. So, yes, Your Honor, I would agree that there is...
Appellant didn't raise what at trial?
The cumulative nature of all of these things, Your Honor. A close review on the record in this case indicates that the military judge actually stopped the defense counsel at one point and said, I want to take these one at a time. So he had the defense counsel for all of the members that this...
Oh, so it's waived?
It wouldn't be waived, Your Honor. It would be...
It's forfeited?
Yes, Your Honor.
In the absence of plain error?
Yes, Your Honor.
So you would like us to remove that language that we should review the totality of the circumstances and that we should only review those bases that were specifically objected to it or brought up, at least at trial?
Well, Your Honor, it's totality of the circumstances. I wouldn't ask that you do that because, in truth, yes, appellant did raise all of these bases. So there's a very good argument that he did, in fact, make a cumulative argument or the military judge should have ruled on that. But the issue here, I would argue, is one of giving appellant what amounts to two bites of the voir dire apple. Essentially, what you're doing by not giving the military judge any deference because he didn't clearly make a cumulative basis argument, therefore, in theory, he would get less deference under this court's ruling. So you're essentially creating an incentive for an appellant to maybe not make all the bases for challenge at the trial court level because he may think that as his case goes on appellate review, these other things might prove to be the thing that gets him relief. So in that regard, while the cumulative argument is probably the hardest one for the government to make that argument with because most of these bases were raised, it is a slippery slope, the government would say, to allow appellant on appeal to get the benefit of looking at bases that he did not raise at the trial court level. And the alternative in that regard, Your Honor, the judge did go through and make detailed findings and did say, I've considered everything, I'm applying a liberal grant mandate, your challenge is denied. So in the alternative, the government would argue that there was a clear signal from the judge that he was considering everything cumulatively, even if the defense counsel didn't specifically raise that basis and the military judge didn't specifically rule on it, he should still be given as much deference as this court does give on such rulings for implied bias.
What about the appellant's contention that he went on and on and on about a actual bias and then blew off implied bias in half a page with an incantation of the liberal grant mandate and nothing more?
Your Honor, reviewing the record, I would disagree with that characterization by appellant.
What is your characterization?
Your Honor, reviewing the record indicates that the defense counsel explained his basis and at the end of each of his arguments would say, it's actual and implied, would just sort of throw them out there, didn't make any distinction with regard to his argument. So the military judge was ruling on it as a total. He wasn't taking up actual bias and then taking up implied bias separately and sort of just tossing out the liberal grant mandate and moving on. He was looking at totality of the argument.
Well, if the judge is looking at the totality, why shouldn't we?
Yes, Your Honor. I do think for reasons when I was discussing with Judge Erdman about why this court, you could argue it is fairly before this court, it should be fairly before this court, but I would note that it is a slippery slope with regard to giving the appellant benefit of arguments that he doesn't make at the trial court level, because it's certainly a different analysis. And in this court has, in the cases where this court has granted relief based on a cumulative argument, appellant cites to the Rome case, and that's important. It can be distinguished from the facts here. In the Rome case, this court found that one basis was itself enough, and that was the UCI issue, that the defense counsel in a previous case had essentially embarrassed the lieutenant colonel on the panel to such a degree that the military, that this court, that was too much. It was not going to bear out. That this court did say, even if that wasn't enough, there was all these other bases at trial. But it's important to note, once again, in that case, there was one basis that was enough. And in this case, the government would argue there's simply not one basis of those that were raised at the trial court level that is enough. And that's why I, at the beginning, urged this court to unpack, if you will, the three bases that were raised at the trial court level and appellant has briefed. First, with regard to Lieutenant Colonel DS being a sexual assault victim, the facts of Lieutenant Colonel DS's case were sufficiently dissimilar from the facts of the case at issue, Sergeant Castillo's case. This is not a case where we are worried about, in the words of this court in Lavender, you have someone who's standing in the shoes of the victim. Lieutenant Colonel DS indicated in the individual voir dire that he had been sexually assaulted by a man who was 18. Lieutenant Colonel DS doesn't indicate how old he is, but there's a clear indication that he's younger than that. In this particular case, the charges on the charge sheet that went to trial were a spousal rape and an assault. Essentially, the appellant went to a barbecue, got drunk, came home, had an altercation with his wife where he allegedly threw her up against a wall, rendering her unconscious, and then raped her.
Well, what about Dalton? Dalton, you had the same offense, but it didn't even happen to the member. It happened to the mother and sister of the member, and we said, get him off.
Yes, Your Honor, and that case can be distinguished from the facts in this particular case. In Dalton, there were two members that were on issue at appeal. The first was a medical doctor who treated victims of child sexual assault, and this court said, no error. The judge was correct in not granting the challenge. This court did find error with regard to the other major, and that was because her mother and her sister had both been abused as children. Her sister was approximately the same age as the victim in that case. And her responses, importantly, to the military judge's questions were, in the words of the court, less than resounding. When during the individual voir dire, when asked by the military judge whether she could put this aside, she essentially said, I'll try, but I'm really not sure if I can do that. In this case, we have not only very dissimilar facts, we also have the member who himself said, almost sua sponte, I don't see them as the same issue at all. I'm not going to be affected. It's not going to affect me in any way. And the military judge noted that when he was making his ruling and also talked about the credibility and the demeanor and appearance of that member when asking the questions or answering the questions, Your Honor. So I would submit that that's the really important distinction. It's not only just the facts of the case, but also the member's responses.
What is your most problematic fact if you were going to step back and pretend you are a member of the public applying the implied bias test, and you looked at this case, what would be the fact you would zero in for further discussion? And note that I'm not asking you to concede something. I'm asking you to zero in for further discussion on the most problematic fact.
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, the most problematic fact is really the cumulative effect. Once you start looking at all these things together, that, I believe, would be the appellant's best argument in this case.
What about the fact that all the officers or all the members came from the same brigade? Is that of any concern?
Your Honor, no. And the reason why is that it's not a per se disqualification. And as Your Honor noted, this court-martial was taking place in Korea, which is not the CONUS, essentially, not the United States. It could very well
Thank you for that.
It could very well be that there are limited panel members.
It could very well be, but what's the record reflect?
It doesn't reflect much, Your Honor. But that goes back to appellant and his burden. And this court had said also in Lavender that appellant can't decide to not go into prejudicial information and then basically complain about it later. And that's, while in that case it was really about talking to particular members about biases, the government would argue the same thing applies here. Once again, it's as I said before, it's the two bites of the voir dire after problem. Appellant in his reply brief says, well, the judge was on notice. He had the convening order. He knew that all these people were from the same brigade. Well, the same argument can be applied to the appellant. If he was going to take issue with everyone being from the same brigade and wanted to use that as a basis for challenge, the time to do so was at trial before the military judge, so the government could make a record and the military judge could make a ruling. This is not a fact that should be unnoticed or was somehow hidden. We're not talking about, you know, secret meetings between trial counsel and a member that no one knows about until after the fact. This was all out there. So therefore, while it could, I suppose, be argued that it was on the military judge, it could just as well be argued that it's on appellant, and that's his job at voir dire, is to seat a panel and do the best for his client, and he should be held to that standard.
What about the rating relationship between among three of the members?
Yes, Your Honor. By the time the panel was sat, you had Lieutenant Colonel Diaz, and you had his Command Sergeant Major, and you had also his S2. Now, it's important to note that Lieutenant Colonel Diaz had only been in command for about 3 months, had conducted initial counseling with the Command Sergeant Major, and apparently had done some maybe performance-based counseling with the S2. Other than that, they really had not had any interaction. And this certainly doesn't rise to the level of Wiesen, where this court essentially announced a per se rule where if it's sufficient to convict, that's probably going to be enough. In this case, we have far less that's required to convict. You have 3 members out of the 7 that sat on the panel. And you also are talking about a Lieutenant Colonel as Command Sergeant Major. And the military judge noted this when he talked about denying that challenge, because he said, you're talking about a very senior enlisted who's been selected to be a Command Sergeant Major. Just because you're an E9 does not mean that you get to be a Battalion Command Sergeant Major. That's an important position, and you're selected for it. So the members also said individually that they would have no problem sitting on this panel, that they would not feel inhibited. Both Lieutenant Colonel Diaz said that, as did the Captain and the Command Sergeant Major. And the military judge said you would expect a Command Sergeant Major to be able to hold his own, and he indicated that he was going to be able to hold his own. And in this case,
but from an implied bias viewpoint, regardless of the actual bias, where they say it wouldn't affect my deliberation, how does that look to a member of the public where they're thinking, gee, if I were with my boss in a panel, a jury, and I was a juror, and my boss feels strongly in terms of voting a particular way, couldn't this hypothetical member of the public be saying, you know what, that would affect, in the civilian world, how someone might vote in the course of jury deliberation?
Your Honor, it's important to note that this court has said that hypothetical member of the public has to be familiar with the military justice system, which would imply also a knowledge of simply how our system works. And it's not unusual for members of the same command to sit on a panel, And once again, it goes to the whether or not this court wants to announce a per se rule that individuals from the same command who may or may not even have a rating.
I'm focusing, though, on the rating relationship.
Yes, Your Honor. Unless this court wants to announce a per se rule that you can't sit with someone that you rate or who rates you on a panel, that would have to be otherwise. That would have to otherwise be the test, because this.
What about a rebuttable presumption?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, in this case, if this court wants to adopt a rebuttable presumption standard for this or for any other basis, the government would argue, well, this is not the case where the government didn't rebut that presumption, because this is a case where you have, as I said, even less than a majority who have some kind of related rating relationship. And we're talking about the two most senior members in the battalion, first of all, and then the S2, who's once again a commissioned officer. He's a captain. And I guess I would say this is that.
So if we had more than a third who were rated, would you find bias there?
No, Your Honor, the government's not in favor of a rebuttable presumption or any kind of per se rule, and that's the problem, is because where do you draw the line? The government would argue that the way the system is now is workable. It's everyone has to put those relationships on the record, and then defense counsel has an opportunity and should have as much opportunity as they want to delve into those particular facts. I would draw the court's attention to its decision in Richardson, and that was on point for this case as well, because the problem in that case was that the military judge denied the defense an opportunity to talk to three out of the four members later on during the voir dire process. They talked to these members, some additional information came out about their relationship with the trial counsel, and the defense counsel wanted to bring the members back to talk a little bit more about that relationship, to develop the record, to see if there were issues. And the military judge denied it. And that was the problem. And the government would say, that's the way, that system, it didn't work the way it's supposed to at trial, and that was the right decision in that regard. Because the way the system is, defense counsel has great latitude and great opportunity to talk to members, to uncover biases, and to ask questions. And the military judge is held to a standard. This court gives less deference if the military judge essentially does not show his work. And that's also the way that it should work, and the way that it did work in this case.
If it shouldn't be a per se rule and it shouldn't be a rebuttable presumption, you would agree, though, that it is something that the military judge and appellate courts can consider in looking at this, just as a factor, not giving it any particular weight, but having that weight depend on the circumstances.
Yes, Your Honor. So in this court, when it does look at the military judge's decision, it does look at all the underlying facts, but if the military judge shows his work and applies the liberal grant mandate, as he did in this case, he should get the most deference that this court is willing to give. And in this particular case, I once again go back to the three bases, and which is why I asked this court initially to once again unpack these things, because on the surface, it could sound worse than it is, essentially, is what the government would argue in this case. Is, once again, sexual assault victim, we talked about distinguishing that. The ongoing reliance, the battalion commander in command for a short period of time, his command sergeant major, who answered questions, he indicated that he had met with him maybe 4 to 5 times, wasn't really clear on whether or not he received legal advice, but was very clear that he had never talked to him about sexual assault cases or domestic abuse cases prior to this particular case, which once again, we're starting to dial down on the danger of implied bias once we start looking at the members' responses to these individual questions.
But isn't that the actual purpose of doing a cumulative review to see what the effect is cumulatively? You said it may make it look worse than it is. Well, isn't that why you do a cumulative review? You have, in your view, three instances here, and you want to parse them out individually and say they're really not anything. But from a cumulative perspective, we want to look at all of them and accumulate the damage or the potential for damage that all three of them together would do to a member of the public's perception.
Yes, Your Honor, and I would argue two things in that regard. First of all, this goes to the danger of not requiring the appellant to make these challenges at trial explicitly and having the judge rule, because you don't have a record in front of you with the benefit of someone who sat through the process, the military judge, and his feelings on these things. The other problem with it is that it's the something out of nothing problem, which is that, unlike in Rome, as I cited, where there was one basis that was clearly enough In this particular case, the government argued none of these are enough. But if this court simply says, well, even though none of these individually are enough, together they're enough, it essentially is encouraging at the trial level the defense counsel to simply make any challenge that they could and just put it out there on the record, because in the hopes that, well, it's going to look really bad if you don't actually have to, if you're not actually required to get into those individual bases and really unpack the factual basis for each of those challenges.
Would the government then like us to do away with the cumulative analysis in implied bias cases?
No, Your Honor, but I would ask that if this court is going to look at these things cumulatively, that it does so not through the lens of just the challenges on their face on the record, but looking at them after unpacking all of the facts and coming to a conclusion on the basis of each particular challenge. Because moving on to...
Counsel, before you move on, please, if I could just ask a question.
Yes,
you referred to the importance of the military judge showing his work, as you put it. But when it came to the liberal grant mandate, didn't he in just one conclusory sentence say, quote, I have considered the liberal grant mandate, end quote?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that was it?
Yes, Your Honor.
So you're saying
Does that count? Sorry, it's your question. I couldn't
so
wait.
You're saying that that's sufficient, just checking off the box, not showing any work, or do you consider that showing the work?
Your Honor, the government argued that that is showing the work.
Just simply the, as I think Judge Stuckey mentioned, just an incantation of I have considered the liberal grant mandate is sufficient.
Your Honor, I see that I'm out of time. Would you like me to answer the question?
Please.
This case, it would be different. If all he did was say those words, Your Honor, the government would submit you might have a problem. But that was after lengthy argument by counsel and a lengthy decision by the judge. And I would point to this court's decision in Downing. This court didn't ask for record dissertations, but a clear indication that the judge applied the law, and I think you have that in this case. Any further questions? That is all I have.
Okay. Thank you very much, counsel. Counsel for the appellant, you have the opportunity for rebuttal.
There's a reason this court reviews implied bias under the totality of the circumstances. And it's the same reason this court watches television, not to see red, blue, and yellow, but to see the picture as a whole. The picture as a whole in this case presents a panel member who appears to be biased toward the government in a case that was unfairly convened or unfairly constituted as. That is what the public would see in this case. And that's why it's important to review the case as a whole. What would it look like in this case if a member of the public reviewed this record? And in this case, not only do the facts remain a concern, but the military judge's explanation of the facts and discussion of the liberal grant mandate, discussion of implied bias, was wholly insufficient to give anyone confidence that this record reflects anything but implied bias. Under the circumstances, we ask that this court find that Sergeant Castillo's case is unfair, unfairly constituted, set aside the findings, set aside the sentence, and return this case to the hearing. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court thanks both counsel for the arguments, and we stand in recess until further order of the court. Thank you very much.
Court stands adjourned until further order of the court.